Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Thank you so much for tuning into Radical Philosophy. I'm your host, Beth Matthews. Today on the program, I'm going to be speaking with Sandy Jeffs about the philosophy of poetry. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me, Beth.
It's great to have you here. So could you give us some background information about yourself?
Gee whiz, background information. Okay, well, I was born in Ballarat in 1953, so I'm old. I went to school, to Dana Street State School. I went to Ballarat High School. I got my HSC there and got a studentship and went to La Trobe University, as one did back in those days because there were only three universities to go to. And I came to Melbourne, was living in Glen College at La Trobe, sort of flopped through university, staggered through university really, got my degree, a Bachelor of Arts, when a Bachelor of Arts meant something. That was amazing. And then I was supposed to be a teacher because I had a studentship. But I was bonded to the education department for 3 years after my degree. But because I was falling apart in my mind and not knowing that I was becoming unwell mentally, I was floundering. And then I thought to myself, I cannot teach. I have nothing in my heart to give to a kid in a classroom. Also, I thought, I know nothing. I have no knowledge base. So I dumped my studentship. I finished my degree. Then I graduated with a BA thinking, wow, I've got a career ahead of me. I've got adult life to embrace. I've got things to do. Hunky-dory. And then I fell apart and I became psychotic. And in 1976, in December, I was diagnosed with schizophrenia. And that was a death sentence at the time, with no sense of recovery. Schizophrenia and recovery weren't spoken of in the same sentence. And I was told by clinicians basically I would go madder and madder, never recover. And really my life was over and any hope, purpose or meaning I had in my life was torn away like a piece of Velcro. So that was what happened. And that was the beginning of my life with psychosis, schizophrenia.
So what was it that propelled you into writing poetry?
Well, interesting. In my last years at high school, Form 5, Form 6, there were some charismatic teachers who I just loved. Miss Vines in particular, who saved my life. She was an absolute godsend. She said, you're smart enough to go to university. She was the first teacher who ever said to me, you're not dumb. Because I thought I was a dumbass. And so she and other teachers at the time, young teachers who had come to our school, fresh graduates from university, they were fresh out of uni, you know, really enthusiastic teachers. They were so alive and such good role models, I suppose. And they introduced me to the poetry of T.S. Eliot and other poets in Form 5 and Form 6. Not that I understood Eliot's poetry. I had no idea what it was about. However, something in it spoke to me and I just loved the words. I loved the idea of playing with concepts. The whole idea of being a poet was so fanciful but so nice to strive for. And I thought, I really want to be a poet. Without ever having written a poem in my life, I thought, I want to be a poet. And I got to uni and I wrote some really bad attempts at poetry, but it was when I went crazy that I started documenting my madness in poetry. And doing that was really important because it meant that I was writing, I was using my imagination, I was creative, and even when I held that bit of paper in my hands with that written poem on it, which in those days you used a pen and paper, there were no personal computers or anything like that, or iPads, when I held that bit of paper in my hands with the poem on it, at the time, it was the only thing that told me I was alive. It was testament to my existence, that bit of paper with the poem. Nothing else was telling me I was alive. And that was fantastic. So I kept writing. Not that I showed people my poems, but in 1993, when I was 40, I showed Susan Hawthorne my poems. And she had started Spinifex Press then. And she said, I'd like to publish your poems in a book. And Poems from the Madhouse, my first book, was born. And honestly, Beth, overnight, I went from Sandy, schizophrenia, no hope, no purpose, no meaning, to Sandy, poet, hope, purpose, and meaning. And I had a reason to get out of bed. Before that, I had no reason to get out of bed. I was just a wasted life, shattered in my own being. I felt like a failure. I felt like I was a burden on my friends. It was awful, and the existential crisis I was experiencing was just terrible. But to actually be transcended to something different and more positive was so important for me. And becoming a poet and then being recognised as a poet was just absolutely fantastic.
So you've partly answered this question, but what does poetry do for us and how?
I always say that in poetry you can say the unsayable, speak the unspeakable, sense the insensible. And poetry is a way of processing ideas, thoughts into a concrete, concise, really pointed way of saying things. So when I write a poem and I see it on a bit of paper in front of me with the words printed out in black and white, I see things that I don't normally see in life, in general sort of ordinary life. It explains things and it exposes things and it reveals things to you that you don't normally see. And when you're writing a poem, things pop up from your imagination that you didn't know were there. And things that are wondrous sometimes, you think, wow, where did that idea come from? Where did those words come from? Where did that rhyme, that rhythmical thing come from? And so it's a way of translating your experiences into something concrete, meaningful, and often transcendent, because poetry has a transcendent quality to it. In a way, lots of poems are mysteries, and that's good, but sometimes they have to be mysteries you can understand. I mean, Eliot's poetry is a mystery to me, and when I try and decipher his poetry, I have to work really hard because it's so dense and so imbued with his sensibility and his imaginative concept of life. But when you do crack the code of a poem, it's fantastic because it opens up a world of meanings, many different meanings, a whole plethora of meanings. A poem can mean many things. It's who's reading the poem and what they bring to that poem that makes it meaningful. So for me, writing about poetry and writing poetry is wonderful, and you can just say things in a way you don't do it in prose. Poetry is a condensation of your thoughts to make them meaningful but transcendent.
Is it sort of like reading between the lines?
Yeah, it probably is reading between the lines, and you read between the stanzas, you read between the words, because each word is magical in a poem. I often say that poems are like prayers. Every poem is a prayer. And it's like we're praying to the universe with our poetry, praying to the goddess or whatever you want to pray to, and that when you make that prayer, sometimes they're answered, the prayers are answered. Sometimes you've got to struggle to get the answer for the prayer, but it's worthwhile. It's worthwhile praying in poetry because what you get back is tenfold.
It's interesting too, because you can have the same poem and half a dozen people would interpret it in, you know, half a dozen different ways, wouldn't they?
And that's the magic of a poem. That's why it's so magical, because we each bring our own lived experience to it, our own cultural baggage, our own cultural context, our own understanding of poetry. If you have a wider understanding of poetry, you can feed into what you're reading in front of you. So, yes, I think that's the magic of poetry. It can mean so many things to so many people. There's no right or wrong way to interpret a poem. It's what you bring to it and what the poem brings to you. And it's a meeting of the ways. It's a meeting of your sensibility with the poem's sensibility, a meeting of your heart with the poem's heart, and the meeting of your soul with the poem's soul.
Does emerging yourself into writing act as an escape from reality?
Well, given that the world is absolutely psychotically mad, and we have the Oval Office madhouse in Trump's cuckoo's nest running the show, really you need a foil to the mad world. And poetry for me is a safe haven. It's my happy place. It's my It's my not escape from the world. It's my way of processing the world. So for me, poetry is processing all the shit that's going on in the world, all the crap. How do we understand the world? And if you write about it in prose, it's one way. But if you write about it in poetry, you're crystallizing what you're seeing in the world and how it flows into you and flows out into the poem. And when it flows into the poem, it gives it another dimension. So I write a lot about Trump these days. I can't help myself because it's so crazy. The world that we're living in is just out of control. I don't get the world anymore. I feel so alien from the world, and so it's like a stranger walking through it. But in my poetry, it's a way of trying to be less of a stranger and more connected, but connected in a creative, imaginative way.
So would you say poetry to you is you're trying to make sense of the world?
Oh, absolutely. And make sense of myself. When I was crazy trying to make sense of the world, I was writing obsessively about madness, and I have done for a long time. It's about trying to process that experience and make sense of it, because how else can you make sense of a psychotic mind? And for me, it's been through poetry. Seeing yourself in another way, seeing your mind and your thoughts in another way, and then, as I said, crystallizing them in a poem. It is instructive. I'm not saying, though, it makes you immune from going crazy again, or it makes you immune from bad things happening to you, but it's a foil, and it's an attempt to make sort of order out of the chaos that we have around us. For me, poetry is very ordered, and that order and having a sense of order is really important.
And I think, too, people have a sort of a trademark, what's the word I'm trying to think of, brand, and, you know, for poetry. And I'll tell you something quite interesting. One night I tend to think about writing a poem, give it a bit of thought, quite a bit of thought. Then when I sit down to write it, it doesn't take me very long because I've sort of done all the background. So one night I thought, okay, you know, I've got my group tomorrow, got to come up with something. Thought about it for, you know, 3 days. So I sat down and I wrote it in watching a movie, the TV break. So I was very pleased with myself to get the whole poem down in that short period of time. Anyway, my partner came down and sat down, and I said, I've written my poem for tomorrow. You know, how about me? I'm pretty good. And she said, oh, and how long did that take you? And I said, oh, probably about 3.5 minutes. So what she did was she Googled on her phone, and it was about poems about the sea. And she asked AI to write her a poem on the sea, and it came back, Drifters of the Deep. And it came this amazing poem, you know, in a split second. And then she said, well, I've written one in a split second, less than 3.5 minutes. And I said, that is incredible. AI is incredible. I mean, it's scary and, you know, everything else, but it's amazing. So I said, look, send it to me. And this friend of ours, Errol, I send it to her and she prints it out the night before because I don't have a working printer. So I sent her my poem and I sent her Drifters of the Deep. Anyway, when I got there the next day, the writing group, I had a smile on my face. I thought, oh, I'm going to fool everybody. They'll think that I've turned into an amazing poet. So I read it out and I was waiting, and they all said, that's not your style. Mm. I knew you didn't write that. You don't use those words. And I thought, that's very interesting. So everybody has their own style in poetry, and people can actually pick up if you're being a fraud. But what's your idea on AI generally?
Oh, it's scary as it sucked up all my books and essays and using it for whatever the purpose they use it for without no payment at all. No, it's just taking my words and ideas and is using it with no recompense. It's really scary stuff. There is this thing, what's it called? I forgot the There's a test you can do. We try and decipher the AI generated poem from a person who really wrote the poem, and it's quite scary because a lot of people can't tell the difference between an AI generated poem and a person who's written an actual poem. So it's a bit scary. What it can do is frightening. The way it can suck up ideas and then generate a poem in the style of the person you ask it to generate in the style of. And the way it can generate music and musical melodies for songs that you can plug in your lyrics and ask it to write a melody for your lyrics. So it's scary. I suppose the idea that the question is, why would you bother creating anything when you know it's going to be sucked up by AI and you're going to have no recompense for it? That's very scary because why would you bother? It's stealing our ideas, our concepts, our poems, our words, everything. And you sort of wonder, well, why do I bother creating? What's in it for me now to create and be creative? Why bother? And that's worrisome because we bothered in the past because we were making connections with an audience and with a reader, and now AI is doing it for us. So, are we going to be redundant? I hope not. Can anyone really replace a real creative's endeavors? I hope not. But it's so scary. It just worries me because it's such an easy tool to use for people. It's lazy. It's very lazy to use that tool, but it's very scary because it can write novels, it can write poems, it can write songs, it can generate art. What it can do is limitless. And is it going to make us irrelevant? I really hope not, because you hope that our hearts and souls that go into our poems and our creative endeavours are valued by people who do read poems and novels and listen to songs and things. It just really scares me.
Yes, it scares me too. You're right about the not bothering part. But do you think there are benefits in putting your thoughts on paper?
Oh, yeah. It's as I say, it crystallises your feelings and thoughts, and to see them in black and white in a sentence or in a poem or in a paragraph or a page or a book, all that, it's so validating of your imagination and the fact that you're creative. To know, I really need to know I'm creative and still have an imagination. If I felt that I had lost my creativity and that my imagination had been stultified in some way, it would be terrifying because I so value being creative. I've always wanted to be creative. I was in awe of kids at school who were artists and who wrote poems and stuff. I was in awe of them. I thought, wow, they must be geniuses. They write poetry. They paint pictures. And I was just thinking, wow, I so want to be creative. And the fact that I have become creative is such a welcoming thing for me. But I always feel like I'm a fraud. I never feel like a real poet or a real writer. I never feel like I'm actually a proper one. I feel like I suppose it's the, you know, the imposter syndrome stuff. But I've always felt that I've never been a great writer or a great poet. I'm a very minor writer in the great scheme of things and a very minor poet. And that's a bit, you know, and you've got to sort of understand where you sit in the world. And I don't sit up in the high echelon of people. I'm just very, very, very minor in the great scheme of things.
Well, look, I can relate to that. But I've actually read about other people who, for example, very famous philosopher Mary Midgley. She said she didn't start to form opinions or write until she was 50 because she basically had to educate herself about things. And I think sometimes, you know, we see, you know, like, well, I was the same as you when I saw other kids at school who could write poetry and, you know, turn in incredible, you know, assignments. And I struggled to do that. But then I think, well, you know, it's not like my brain was working any less, because I think my brain was always absorbing information, and like everybody's is. But there's just, we have different times in our life when we can actually do things. Mm. And I think, well, certainly nobody would say to Mary Midgley, you're not a real philosopher. You didn't start to write till you were 50. Come on. I mean, and so I think we all do different things at different times, but that doesn't make us any less a philosopher or any less a writer or a poet, really.
Mm.
You know.
No, and it took a bit of a while to find my own voice.
Mm.
I have got a voice, I suppose. It's funny, though, when I read other poems, I think, oh, wow, what a great poem. I want to write in their style. Oh, wow, aren't they great? And so I find myself mimicking other people's styles sometimes because I feel so uncertain about my own style that I think, oh, wow, they're great. We've got to write like that. But we do have our own voice, and I probably have my own voice too, but I'm not really aware of it yet as being a really significant voice or an individual voice. It's I don't know. It's for other people to sort of judge that one. It's hard to disassociate, to separate yourself from your own writing and see it objectively. So I don't know how other people see my writing, but I'm sure they think I have my own voice. It's just that I'm not aware of it sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I've read some of your stuff, and it's great. You're up there.
Actually, could I just, in terms of reading about poetry, could I just read a poem now?
Sure.
It's about what poetry means to me. Because it means a lot to me. It's been so important in my life. It's been my lifesaver. You know, Susan Hawthorne saved my life by publishing me, and poetry has been a lifesaver. And the poem is called Spiritual. It must be heaven to surrender yourself to God and feel his blessing and know he will forgive you no matter what, to know that Jesus died for your sins and Mary is in your corner and your brethren have your back and your prayers will be answered. I wanted all that surety, that certitude of faith, and tried so hard to believe, even suspended disbelief. I jumped on board the Catholic train and rode a few religious miles before alighting at the secular station. There was trouble in religious land. It fueled my madness with visions of the Virgin Mary in glorious technicolor. Oh, the magnificence! And then becoming Eve and giving Adam the apple and bringing original sin into the world. The power, the consequence, the burden, the insanity. Now I know I can't flirt with the spooky. It's too close to my madness. So, although I live in my intellect and see the world through hyper-rational eyes, more importantly, poetry sits deeper in my core. To create the rhythmical and rhyming, to feel the numinous in words, to read and write things I have never known before. This is my safe place, my harbour in which to anchor my holy hunger.
That's fantastic. Yeah, that's really profound. Amazing.
Yeah, it's a new poem. I've only just written it in the last few weeks. Yeah, nice to know that I can still write.
Oh, you certainly can. So what's the theory behind that? What were you wanting to convey with that poem?
Well, people who are very spiritual and have faith. I just don't know how they can believe in a virgin birth, a resurrection, a holy trinity, transubstantiation. Miracles, walking on water, all those things that they believe in their faith, it perplexes me. I just can't do that. And even though in my late teens, early 20s, I did jump on the Catholic train because I thought I was flirting with Catholicism, you know, big time. And then I realised there was a fundamental problem. I didn't believe in God. That was the problem. So how can I adopt this faith without believing in a fundamental precept of it? So I wanted faith somewhere. I was always looking for spirituality and spiritual nurturing somewhere, and I found it in poetry. So even though I do live a very rational life because I am afraid of the spooky because it's too close to my madness, because I have had religious delusional stuff and, you know, a whole lot of psychotic religious stuff, I know it's too close to my madness, so I live a very rational, intellectual life, but poetry is in my core, and that is my spiritual awakening and my spiritual nourishment in my poetry and the idea of poetry.
Yeah, I can really relate to that because I don't have any faith in religion as such, but my faith is in truth. And, you know, I've always very much been a realist. And I think it's really important for people to be able to distinguish between fantasy, you know, and fiction. And I think that's partly why I do the radio program and I interview people. I'm trying to get to the truth of the matter. I think by asking people questions and getting everything, because sometimes it's hard to define what is true and what isn't, because there's so many other factors.
And I think these days people want more fiction than fact.
Oh, yeah.
I think they really fall into more fiction than fact, and that's a worry. Novels and fiction is important. I mean, in terms of how people run their lives and think about themselves, they want fiction, not fact, because they want to be in a fantasy world, not the real world, because the real world is so challenging.
It is. And I mean, you know, well, I live in a bit of a fantasy world. I like horror movies. So that's my escape, you know. But I know it's not true. Well, I really hope they're not true, these horror movies.
No, I hope they're not true either. So my horror movie was Larundel Psychiatric Hospital. But you know, being there was, you know, when you've been in places like Larundel, which is no longer there now, it was on Plenty Road just up from La Trobe University. It was a place of great interest to me. I had many admissions there, but it was, for some people, hell. For other people, it was heaven. For some people, it was carceral and custodial. For other people, it was a place of asylum. But to be there was away from the teeming world. You were in the gardens, you were in the wards. You were away from this mad, mad world out there. And it did provide you a piece of asylum away from the teeming world. And as much as it was troubled and a custodial and, you know, dichotomous place, a place of paradoxes, it was a place where at least you could be away from the madness of the world, but you were engrossed in another madness, the madness around you and your own madness. But it was an interesting place.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like it. So this is part one of a two-part interview. Thanks very much for coming onto the program today.
Thanks for having me.
And today, I've really enjoyed your company, and do stay tuned next month for part two.